The following sermon was delivered by Rabbi Joshua Davidson on the eve of Rosh Hashanah 5775, September 24, 2014.
Yehuda Amichai, the brilliant Israeli poet, wrote, "An Arab shepherd is searching for his goat on Mount Zion. And on the opposite mountain, I am searching for my little boy. An Arab shepherd and a Jewish father, both in their temporary failure. Our voices meet above the Sultan's pool in the valley between us. Neither of us wants the child or the goat to get caught in the wheels of the terrible Had Gad Yah machine. Afterward, we found them among the bushes, and our voices came back inside us, laughing and crying. Searching for a goat or a son has always been the beginning of a new religion in these mountains." So it was this summer, Arab and Jew, a widening valley of destruction and death between them. Amichai's Had Gad Yah machine recalls the Passover story about the stick beating the dog, biting the cat, the song wherein one killing follows another until butcher, ox, and kid all are dead. The image of father and son on the mountaintop recalls Rosh Hashanah's poignant tale, the binding of Isaac. And it came to pass that God tested Abraham and said to him, "Take now thy son, thine only son, whom thou lovest, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the heights which I will show thee." Hundreds of generations have wrestled with this story. Why would God test Abraham, loyal servant, in so cruel a fashion, asking the sacrifice of his beloved son, and in the end demand, "Lay not thy hand upon the child"? It is our tradition's protest against human violence. In ancient days, the ritual slaughter of children was commonplace. Our Torah repudiates it. "Lay not your hand upon your children." God's voice echoes from the mountaintop in the darkness of our own time. The war between Israel and Hamas began with the binding and slaughter, the abduction and murder of three Israeli teens, and then in an atrocious act of vengeance, the killing of one Palestinian teen. Those kidnappings came to encapsulate this latest conflagration. Terrorists emerging out of tunnels into kibbutzim and villages are the stuff of every Israeli's nightmare. How can a country permit such a threat to the safety of its people, its children? How can any other nation condemn Israel for attempting to eliminate it? It cannot be that the citizens of the State of Israel will live under the threat of missiles and infiltration, death from above and death from below, insisted Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Indeed, it cannot be. I will not rehearse the tragedy. You read the news and watched the footage, which in too many instances failed to portray the hostilities accurately or fairly. In the Jewish Week, editor and publisher Gary Rosenblatt decried the frequent portrayal by journalists of the Israeli and Hamas narratives as parallel stories of frustration, an injustice which, in his words, maintains the fiction that the IDF and Hamas operate on some kind of equal moral footing when one side uses Iron Dome rockets to protect its citizens and the other uses citizens as human shields to protect its rockets. To assert a moral equivalency, he goes on, When Israel mourns the deaths of innocent Gazans in harm's way and Hamas deliberately places them there, is more than a dereliction of one's journalistic duties. It is an obscenity that must be exposed and condemned. By their own admission and editorial policy, some international outlets are voraciously biased against Israel. But other journalists were victims of intimidation by Hamas and feared for their own lives. They could not portray the terrorist organization in action and needed to wait to be home and safe before they finally acknowledged that Hamas was firing rockets from mosques, hospitals, and schools, which tragically but knowingly resulted in their own citizens' deaths. But as my Israeli friend and colleague, Rabbi David Foreman of blessed memory, always said of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's complicated. We understand. This war that left more than 70 Israelis dead killed more than 2,100 Palestinians, many of them innocents caught in the crosshairs. And because the IDF commits to every reasonable precaution to minimize civilians and casualties, it has acknowledged the responsibility to investigate some of those deaths, including the killing of 4 Palestinian children playing soccer on a beach and the shelling of a UN school. If we believe that every human being, Jew or Muslim, Israeli or Arab, is created B'Tselem Elohim in God's image, and we do, then we must indeed acknowledge the suffering of Palestinian civilians as a moral issue. But at the same time, we must insist that the terrorizing of Israelis is also a moral issue, and not just the self-interested concern of the Jewish community. Israel has every right to defend itself. What Abba Ibn said years ago is true today. The moral responsibility of Israel does not extend to its own suicide. While the complexity of events may defy headlines or sound bites, the ethical questions they raise must not be ignored. And so this congregation shall not. On the evening of November 5th, the Temple Emanuel Skirball Center will host Israel in the Eyes of the Media. And Gary Rosenblatt will moderate a discussion on this very topic between author Dr. Daniel Gordis and Ethan Bronner, deputy national editor of the New York Times and formerly the paper's Jerusalem bureau chief. For the Jewish community, the conflict triggered other terrifying alarms. In Europe's capitals, where support for Israel now wavers, and on Europe's streets, where a spate of anti-Semitic activity exploded as frightening as any since the Holocaust. Fortunately, the majority in America backed Israel in its efforts against Hamas, but not so in Europe. In England, Italy, Belgium, France, Austria, boycotts, hate speech, swastikas, synagogues firebombed, Jewish businesses burned. Even in Germany, where never again are national watchwords, again calls to gas the Jews. Every Shabbat, we welcome visitors from around the world. They tell me what they warn their children back home. Don't tell people you are Jewish. Hide your Star of David inside your shirt on the metro. Take down your mezuzah. The Central Council of Jews in Germany reports hundreds asking whether it's safe to remain. People are afraid. When calls for Jews to be gassed, burned, and murdered are bawled on the streets, said the council president, that no longer has anything to do with Israel's politics in Gaza. It is the most abhorrent form of anti-Semitism. To this, European governments appear somewhat more responsive. A The foreign ministers of Italy, Germany, and France jointly condemned the tide of anti-Semitism rising even before the Israel-Gaza conflict. But the surge has not abated. French Prime Minister Manuel Valls justifiably labeled it a new normalized anti-Semitism. So acceptable has it become to condemn Israel and then to obliterate the boundary between Israel and all Jews. Anti-Israel has become interchangeable with anti-Jewish. Some argue that this is a Muslim phenomenon, that angry Muslim youth are instigating most of the vitriol and violence. Certainly, we would never deny the threat of Islamic extremism, against which America just this week entered a new phase in an ongoing struggle. Nor would we deny the reality of anti-Semitism in some Muslim quarters. But too many of Europe's cultural and academic elites have condoned it with their silence. Recently, I received a letter from one of our congregants. "Dear Rabbi Davidson," it began, "not long ago I met some Jewish people on a trip. They were from France, and they could only talk about moving to Israel because France is so anti-Semitic that it is hell for Jews to live there." Perhaps when one inhabits a society where living a Jewish life comes with risk, one better understands the importance of a Jewish homeland for Jewish survival. But the danger to us exists not only in those other countries. It threatens here at home, too. Rabbi Yehuda Sarna, director of NYU's Bronfman Center for Jewish Student Life, believes this is going to be one of the most difficult semesters for Israel on college campuses in a long time. Not just because of the war over the summer, but also because the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, which blames Israel for the failure of the two-state solution, has been gaining steam, and the war provides the fodder for the momentum to continue. Anti-Israel bias already pervades radical campus groups and has seeped into Middle Eastern studies and other academic departments. Pro-Palestinian associations will point to recent photos portraying Israel as the aggressor and liken it to South Africa under apartheid. Most students are ill-prepared to respond. Earlier, I shared with you the good news that most Americans supported Israel against Hamas, 53% over 50 years of age. But now the bad news. According to Gallup, among Americans 18 to 29, only 25% do. And too many of those are ours. Experts predict it won't be long before Jewish BDS associations operate on all college campuses. Groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, which not only advocates BDS, but has called for the suspension of the U.S. military aid to Israel, so vital in protecting millions of Israelis from Hamas rockets. Can you imagine what would have occurred in Israel without the Iron Dome? Over this summer alone, JVP gained 50,000 supporters. And yet another battleground I addressed in a recent article: the Presbyterian Church USA. In brief, for the last 10 years at its biennial denominational gatherings, the PCUSA has debated selective divestment from corporations it claims further Israel's occupation of Palestine. Until this past summer, the resolution had been defeated. But last year, the denomination promoted a congregational study guide titled "Zionism Unsettled," not just anti-Israel, but anti-Semitic. It is horrific. And then in June, at the most hurtful moment imaginable, as World Jewry was holding its collective breath, praying that the three kidnapped Israeli teens would come home alive, the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly narrowly voted to divest from Israel. Now understand this. The vote of the General Assembly by no means represents the views of every churchgoer. To the contrary, the leaders of New York's largest Presbyterian congregations have been vocal in their opposition to the divestment resolution. In July, they convened a meeting I attended with the denomination's national leadership so that our local Presbyterian clergy could express their frustration. I shared with the moderator, the church's highest elected official, my own resentment, compounded by the church's biased, blatantly inaccurate statements blaming Israel for the Gaza conflict. In writing, he assured me that such errors would be corrected. So I do believe that what has been a critically important interfaith partnership between the Jewish and Presbyterian communities can be repaired. But I also believe in this, as in many other areas, we have a role to play. With regard to the PCUSA, my local colleagues and I have committed to working with the denomination's leaders to broaden their understanding of the history and complexity of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But there is more you and I must do. Even as we defend journalistic and artistic freedom, we must denounce any expression of it in the media or in the opera house, which confuses terrorists with their victims. Similarly, we must defend Israel against the new anti-Semitism that masquerades as anti-Zionism. The repugnant mangling of history, likening Israel to Nazi Germany, reeks of anti-Jewish hatred. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks reminds us, criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitism, but demonization is. Israel's policies can be legitimately criticized by fair-minded observers, but the criticism must be legitimate and it must be fair. And in conversations with our friends or coworkers or college-aged children or grandchildren, we must insist on it. Now, we who love Israel and who must not stand on the sidelines while Israel is slandered should nonetheless be willing to acknowledge that Israel does need to do more to end this conflict. It took a courageous first step toward easing border restrictions last week, allowing the import of rebuilding materials into Gaza. Now Israel needs vigorously to promote greater economic and educational opportunities for its own citizens of Arab descent. It needs to investigate the claims of its intelligence officers, who last week alleged the political persecution of innocent Palestinians. And Israel must take seriously the criticism of the Presbyterian Church and others across the religious and political spectrum who condemn settlement expansion. The recent seizure of 1,000 acres of West Bank land, even if that land ultimately will belong to Israel in a permanent agreement, seems incompatible with serious aspirations toward peace. For far too long, the government's support of the settler movement has undermined the prospects of a two-state solution, and the window for such a solution is closing fast. We must confront our own fundamentalists, who, blinded by their vision of a greater Israel, bury their heads in the sand and refuse to see that peace represents Israel's last hope to remain a democratic Jewish state. The story of the binding of Isaac was written as a polemic against fundamentalism of every stripe, Jewish fundamentalism included. So yes, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is complicated. So complicated, an article in Monday's New York Times noted that many congregations and rabbis prefer just not to talk about it. but we will not bend its complexity into an excuse for walking away from Israel or giving up on peace. In mid-July, Nicholas Kristof captured a moment of extraordinary poignancy in the conflict. In the carnage of Gaza and the Middle East, the most unlikely people have stepped forward from their grief to offer moral leadership, he wrote. The family of Naftali Frankel, a 16-year-old Jewish boy who was one of the three kidnapped and murdered, said after the revenge killing of Muhammad Abu Qadir, "There is no difference between Arab blood and Jewish blood. Murder is murder." Likewise, the father of the Palestinian boy said, "I am against kidnapping and killing, whether Jew or Arab. Who would accept that his son or daughter would be kidnapped and killed? I call on both sides to stop the bloodshed." In the end, Abraham does not sacrifice his son. "Lay not thy hand upon the child," calls the voice from the mountaintop. How we yearn to hear Moriah's voice today. There is so much wrong in the world. Beheadings in Syria, Ebola in West Africa, Russian tanks in Ukraine, American tanks in Ferguson, anti-Semitism in Europe, war in Israel. One congregant recently lamented, "I can't help thinking that the world is coming apart at the seams, that the end is near." Indeed, it sometimes appears to be. But we Jews, especially on this holy day, affirm the need for hope. In a beautiful lesson from the Quran, Muhammad teaches that even if the world is coming to an end tomorrow, each of us must plant a seed today. And if someone asks us, "Why are you planting a seed when the world is coming to an end?" we are to answer, "Because there must always be hope." We can plant seeds. Seeds of peace, supporting the organization of that very name, which nurtures relationships between the next generations of Israelis and Palestinians and youth from other regions in conflict. We can plant seeds of tolerance within the Jewish community and repudiate zealots like Pamela Geller, whose American Freedom Defense Initiative just last week purchased more billboards equating all Islam with terror and hate. We can plant seeds of understanding within the American Christian and Muslim communities, building awareness of the existential dangers Israel faces. And we can plant seeds of commitment within our own children and grandchildren to the centrality of Israel, to Jewish survival and Jewish identity. Some of you may know that story from the Quran is paralleled in our Talmud. One day, Honi went walking and came upon an old man planting a carob tree. "How long until this tree bears fruit?" he inquired. 70 years, the man answered, whereupon Honi asked, "And do you believe you will live to see it?" The old man replied, "As my ancestors planted for me, so I plant for my children." A beautiful message. But the story doesn't end there. Honi sat down and fell asleep, and he slept for 70 years. When he awoke, he saw a man picking fruit from the tree and asked him, "Are you the same man who planted this tree?" "No," the man responded. "I am his grandson." Yehuda Amichai understood. No war can last forever. Our failure is temporary. Peace will come. One day, we too will awaken to a new reality. Until that day, we will stand with our people the world over and with Israel, the cradle of our history, our spiritual home. And we will keep planting seeds, because there must always be hope. Amen.